feel pretty lousy today. It's a beautiful day outside. So am I under the weather? If you're under the weather on a beautiful day, does that mean you're in good shape? I don't know how that works. I was wondering that as I was getting ready. For the last few days, I've been fighting something. I feel good for part of the day, and then I feel terrible. So I won't stick around. I won't breathe on you all afterwards. For your sakes. Well, came on automatically before. This time I don't want to. This should be all right, I think. Okay. Thanks for your patience, sir. Angled the thing that way so Josh can see it. He holds down the port side of our hall every week. So in the last sermon that I gave, we looked at some detail of what it's like to be a Jew in the province of Judea in Jesus' time, in the area that surrounded Jerusalem and was around the temple. We saw that the Romans pretty much left them alone to practice their religion without interference. We looked at how some of the purity laws that in the Torah apply to the priests in their service to the temple had undergone a bit of mission creep, and according to the Pharisees and others, were to apply to the average person. For whatever reason. And that's, you know, if you believe them anyway. We also saw how a lot of Jesus' stories, his parables and his comments were designed precisely to fight this mission creep, to get people to focus on their moral behavior, what was in their hearts, and that God was worried about their hearts and not so much about their physical rituals. But one thing we need to remember now, and that is that Judea was just a very small province, right there. Very small province in the Roman Empire. Now, this is the Roman Empire as of early 2nd century, 125 for this map. So Britain might not have been a part of it then at Jesus' time and other places. But in general, this is what it was like. But Judea is a very small province over here, kind of on the frontier. And the main reason the Romans cared about it at all is because there was a trade route that went from northern Africa up through here, and there's Antioch and so forth, important cities along the way. So we must remember that there were many more Jews in the rest of the empire than there were in Judea. And today, what I want to talk about is what it was like for these Jews in the rest of the empire. How did they practice their religion? And how was this received by their non-Jewish neighbors? How did these Jews seek to maintain purity and distinctiveness in the midst of the very pagan Roman Empire? And how was it different from what we learned about the province of Judea? And lastly, and maybe most importantly, why should we care? Well, let's answer that last question first. Why does it matter? Why do I care about studying this? Why am I going to share it with you? And my reason is really very simple. Our New Testament is made up of four Gospels, Book of Acts, which is like a history, and then a bunch of letters for the most part. And the Gospels, in order to understand the Gospels, we understand the Roman world, but we understand it perhaps from the perspective that we talked about in the last sermon, what it was like in Judea, what it was like where Jesus was, where the apostles were. But if we want to understand the rest of the New Testament, what Paul was talking about, perhaps what some of the other letter writers were talking about, what the history in Acts was about and what was the background to it, we need to understand a little bit more about what was going on in the rest of the empire and not just this one little place. Of course, this was a little place was very important because that's where Jerusalem was and that's where the temple was. So it was very important to the Jews. It wasn't necessarily all that important to the Romans in the same sense. It was strategically important. Not that they cared there was a temple there. But in the book of Acts, Paul traveled to many cities of the Roman diaspora. And actually, in the early church there, actually, before Paul. We've read before in Acts 2. You know, when the apostles started speaking in other languages, where were these people from? It says there were Parthians. Well, Parthia is way over here. All right, it's not even, Parthia wasn't really part of the Roman Empire. I don't think there's any province called Parthia. It says the Medes and the Elamites, okay, we're over here in this part of the world. And residents of Mesopotamia, where Babylon was. And you notice that the title of this sermon was Jews in the Mediterranean Diaspora. There were many more Jews over here in Babylon. Because remember, the Babylonians had taken the Jews captive. And only a few of them came back to rebuild the temple and rebuild Jerusalem. So there was a large community, very large community in the vicinity of Babylon. We're not going to talk about them at all because there's no letter specifically to them. And and they're different. They behave different. They had they wrote their own Talmud. They were a huge community. Judea, Cappadocia. Well, Cappadocia is up here somewhere. I can't see too well. Where is it? It's behind there. Pontus and Asia. Now, when it says Asia, it's talking about the province of Asia. Oh, there's Cappadocia. Sorry, and the province of Asia, which is Turkey today, part of Turkey. Phrygia, which is up there as well. And what else? Pamphylia, Egypt, down here in Egypt. All right. And districts behind Libya and Cyrene, which are coming this direction. And visitors from Rome, both Jews and proselytes. Cretans, you had people from Crete. You even had Arabs. So there were Jews all over the place. There were Jews in Spain. Paul said he wanted to visit Spain. We don't know that he ever made it, but he wanted to visit Spain. There were Jews there. Until late Middle Ages. Lots of them. And so these were people that were there at that Pentecost in Acts 2. But also, Paul, in his journeys, traveled to these cities. And we could go down that list. You know what they are. Antioch and Lystra and Derbe and Iconium and the other Antioch and Pisidia. And up in Philippi, the third or second journey, he got up into Greece. Into Philippi and the second and third journey. Thessalonica, I don't say that properly. Down into Athens, Corinth. So he visited all these cities. And when he wrote to these cities, it would help to understand a little bit about what the people in those cities were experiencing, what their lives were like, if we want to understand the letters. Because these were the people he wrote to. Why does it matter? Well, I think we can have a better understanding of what Paul said if we understand a little bit more about the world where Paul traveled. Now, first of all, I want to take a detour, if I might, into Pauline scholarship. Paul was viewed during the Reformation, first by Luther, as... I'm going to paraphrase this. I'm not a scholar. I'm not an expert at how to say it. But the idea was that Paul was kind of the originator of Christianity and not Jesus. And that Paul, that I think I have a note here. Well, it led to centuries of incorrect Protestant New Testament exegesis. Over there were Sewerks. They probably still teach this. The idea that that Paul raised a Jew who was very careful about the purity laws and very careful about the Torah, came to realize through his experience in being knocked down and going to the desert for 3 years and all of that, came to realize that Judaism was a works religion and that's not what it was about. It was about grace. And from Luther on, really until today, but more specifically until at least halfway through the last century, that's the way people wrote about Paul and what he taught and what he did. And what we have happened in the middle of the last century, or toward the 70s, I guess, by Sendall. I've quoted him before, E.P. Sanders and many others. We have Paul, and I use this term, being rescued. But people pointing out, number one, by looking at the original, looking at the Bible and the other records that we have, that Jews did not see their religion at the time of Jesus as a works religion. They understood grace. It was by God's grace that they were chosen. They were the children of Abraham. That's God, by God's grace. They didn't do anything to deserve that, and they understood that. And we have some scholars in the latter part of the last century who finally started teaching that, started researching it and writing books and going more and more into Paul's life. And it's continuing now. In fact, of course, your tradition, I guess most everybody in this room, you know, same as mine, Paul's starting to sound pretty familiar to what we always taught, that Paul was a Jew, remained a Jew, kept God's law. The difference might be between what most scholars would believe and what we kind of taught was the extent to which Paul and the apostles expected non-Jews to keep Torah. And I'm not going to get into that too much today, but there's obviously still debate on that issue. But we have centuries. If you read a typical commentary or a typical book on Paul from anywhere between the 1500s and the 1900s, you're going to find probably that they will characterize Paul as somebody who realized his Jewishness was kind of bankrupt, and he needed to do something else, and he needed to start understanding grace, as if the Jews didn't understand grace. Well, late in the last century, scholars started to realize that's not true at all. That's a mischaracterization of Paul, and we knew that all along from way our particular reading of the New Testament. And to me, it's clear. Paul said on numerous occasions, you know, he was a Pharisee, son of a Pharisee. He still followed the laws. He still followed Torah. you know, what he taught the Gentiles is a different issue. And he taught Jews to keep Torah. Remember when he came back into Jerusalem, late in his life, when he was finally arrested and appealed to Caesar, had to go to Rome, that. He took a vow or paid for some other's vows and you know, purified himself and went in and did some rituals in the temple, which people could do when they were visiting Jerusalem. He wasn't from Jerusalem. He was from Troas. Most Jews in the world were not from Jerusalem. The only time they could make a sacrifice is if they made a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. So if you read about Paul, you got to pay attention to what you're reading, who you're reading it from, and when it was written, because things have changed in our lifetime. And it's still changing. And in fact, I don't know that I have it here in this slide, but there's a radical, what do they call it? There's the new perspective on Paul, and there's like the radical new perspective on Paul. And you know, there's always somebody trying to go in a different direction. But more and more scholars are starting to realize that Paul not only remained a Jew, but taught Jews to remain Jews. And that he wasn't trying to found a different religion. So I think they got that part right. But it's taken 4 centuries to get there. All right, back to Paul's journeys. Let's see if there's anything else I wanted to say here on this. So, I mean, in the old way, when you read it, it's like Paul was the founder of Christianity, not Jesus. Jesus was this Jew who kept the law. Paul was liberated from the law. Okay? And there's many Protestant churches that believe exactly that still. It's in the newer scholarship, more scholars would say that Jesus and Paul were consistent with one another. All right, let's get back to Roman cities. Look at Paul's journeys. You know, where did he go? Well, he went to cities, right? Why did he go to cities? Why did he go to cities? Concentration of people. Where the synagogues were. All right. It was where. I might have a slide on this. Yeah. Here we go. Roman cities, by the way, were not Roman. They were Greek. Does that make sense? No. Well, I mean, it was a Greek culture. There wasn't much of a Roman culture. People were not speaking Latin. Maybe in Rome. Maybe in the province of Africa, which is northern Africa, where Libya is today. But the rest of the empire was not speaking Latin. It was speaking Greek. And the institutions in the cities were Greek. And the philosophy was Plato's and his descendants. So the cities is where, that's where people were, obviously. It's not like today where we can live in the country and have support. You know, there weren't too many people that lived in the country. And those who did probably didn't speak Greek, because Hellenization never got to them. And probably couldn't read or write, although a lot of people in the cities couldn't read or write either. So the cities had the support. They had family support, community support. That's where things were happening. That's where you had the critical mass that life as it was in the Roman Empire could happen. Yeah, they'd go out in the countryside and farm, but they lived in the cities. It's still that way in some parts of the world. It's where the Jews, the countryside was not Hellenized. The cities are where the Jews settled, as Sue said. It's where the synagogues were. So the Jews, when they left the area of Palestine, Israel, whatever it was when they left, Palestine was an area, it was a Roman area. You're not making a political statement when you talk about Palestine in history. That's what the Romans call that area. But the Jews settled in cities. They went where there was support for them, where there was family, where there were institutions. That's where jobs were. And customers, if you had a trade. Why do people live in cities now? Same reasons. It's just more important then. Now you can call with some jobs and some careers, you can live almost anywhere. But that back then, it wasn't that way. Paul, you notice when we read about his travels, it says a lot of times he talks about that he set up with somebody and practiced his trade. What was his trade? Anybody remember? Tent makers. He was a leather worker. I never thought of this before. All these years, never thought. Why was there a demand for tent makers? Did they have a popular, you know, RV industry? And people buy tents, go camping. Why was there a demand for tent makers? The huge Bedouin population, you think? What do you think? I never thought of this before. Who was the main consumer of tents in the Roman Empire? Roman army. Now, I'm not saying that Paul made them for the army, but the point is the demand was there because the army needed tents. Regardless of why anybody else needed them, there was always a demand for tents. Because the Roman army was a huge institution and a powerful institution. And I'm going to wander a little bit, apologize, kind of, but sometime I'm going to want to talk about the Roman Empire a little bit just to give you some more flavor and background. But a lot of times in the empire, when you get into the late first century and beyond, it was the military that decided who the emperor was going to be. You know, they had a lot of power. Before that, you had a republic. I might as well talk about this now. People understand we had a republic. Before Jesus was born, you had a Roman republic. It was run by the elite families in Rome, the senatorial class, the equestrian class. I don't understand all about these classes. But you had rich people with connections that ran the empire. Remember when Antiochus IV, the one we call Antiochus Epiphanes, all right? When he came down and he went through Jerusalem and then he went to Egypt, he was going to attack the Ptolemies down there, and Egypt had appealed to Rome. I told you the story before. And some senator showed up and told him, in so many words, go home. And he said, I'll think about it. And a senator went, drew a circle in the sand and said, you'll think about it inside that circle. And you know what? He went home. Because Rome was powerful. And all it took was a senator to say that. And then he wreaked havoc. That's when he took it out on the Jews in Jerusalem. And some of the worst persecution that was after that. After he had to go back to Antioch or wherever his headquarters was with his tail between his legs. Why did I get on that? Because Rome was a republic run by those families. After Julius Caesar, and he had adopted Octavian to be his son and his successor. So Octavian, who became known as Augustus, who was the emperor when Jesus was born and very young. He was the first emperor where it was the emperor calling the shots and not the Senate. The first emperor in that sense. But still, for some period of time, and I don't know exactly how much of the period of time, let's say for a couple hundred years anyway, there was still that Roman elite in the city of Rome, these senators, these powerful people that still had a lot of power, even though it was the army that decided who the emperor was, or whoever won the civil wars that decided who the emperor was. But once you became emperor, you had to deal with these senators. And if you didn't deal with these senators very well, or if you crossed certain lines, they had the power to get rid of you. Not by telling you you weren't going to be emperor, but by getting rid of you literally. When Claudius, who was, Caligula, who was kind of crazy, he stepped over a whole lot of lines. He didn't get along with the Senate. He also declared himself a god while he was alive. He wanted to retire and go down to Alexandria, or down to Egypt somewhere, and have him worship him as a god. And the Roman senators said, this is ridiculous. And they killed him. They had a conspiracy, and they killed him. Nero was going to be executed, but he killed himself before they had a chance to do it. Because he was crazy, and he didn't get along, and he kind of wanted worship too. There was a time later on, way after the Bible times here, that Roman emperors were worshipped. You may have heard, I've heard. I mean, you've heard this, that, you know, that in Rome, the emperors were worshipped as gods. That's true, but depends on when. The time of Jesus, time of the apostles, no. They were not worshipped as gods. And when Caligula decided he wanted to be worshipped as a god, he got assassinated. Not just for that, for a lot of reasons. But that was one of the things where he crossed the line that they still had in society. In Roman cities, we're talking about Roman cities, there was still a Greek model where you fulfilled your public service by putting on theatrical events, athletic events, all kinds of events for a public, the public good, I guess you'd say. And who put them on? Well, it was the rich people in town. It wasn't the government. It was the leading citizens. They were expected to support the empire in these ways. That's a very Greek idea. And it went that way until late in the 3rd century. And then you start with Diocletian and some other emperors, you start getting more of a, let's focus on the emperor and let's please him. But before that, it was you still had certain things you were supposed to do for the community. And you didn't expect the government to necessarily do everything. So it's not true, at least from what I've learned, it's not true that the emperors were worshipped as gods. However, it was assumed that upon their death they would join the gods. And in a sense, while they were alive, their genius, that's a Latin word, I'm not sure exactly what it means, it has to do with their being, their essence, their soul, was kind of like godlike. It was going to join the gods when they died. So you could say, in that sense. But they didn't want to be worshipped, and when they did, that was crossing a line that even regular pagan Romans did not like. At least not the elites. They didn't like it. All right, back to the cities. Do I have any more to say here? It's where the public services were. It's where you could, I got a picture later on. I'll show you one of the public services in a city. I don't know where I have it. It could be as simple as where the bathrooms were. But, you had things. You had things in the cities that you didn't have elsewhere. Food, clothing, education, perhaps. Some kind of a government structure that made things happen. Somebody you could appeal to. Courts you could appeal to if somebody had a problem with somebody. Rome had a very well-developed legal system and laws. And some of those laws specifically affected the Jews, sometimes in good ways. And the cities, I think we said, is where people spoke Greek. Greek was Rome's lingua franca, if I can make a pun. English was like the English of the day. You could go around the world and speak Greek. That's why Paul could do his missionary work, because the Roman Empire was, at least in the cities, was a Greek-speaking empire, and Paul spoke Greek, so he could do it. Anybody else could do it. You could travel. You could trade. It was because under Alexander and under the generals that succeeded him, the Greek culture went all over the world, including all the way, you know, into Asia, over toward India. I mentioned that leading citizens funded and organized the public activities. And all of these public activities were conducted in the name of the local gods. That's just the way it was. And we're going to talk a little bit more about this in a minute. But it wasn't unusual. This is the way it was. This was normal. It was expected that all would honor the local gods. Everybody would honor. And I'll explain why this is perfectly understandable in their culture, maybe not in ours. Honoring these gods involved sacrifices, just like in Jerusalem when you honored Yahweh. You perform sacrifices, right? What was like that in every other city? You just weren't honoring Yahweh. You were honoring somebody else. And that's where, guess what? That's where the meat came from in the markets. Primary source. It wasn't the only source, but it was the primary place that meat came from in the markets. Okay. Everybody see that? That's not a line through it. That's a guy wire for an adjacent pole. There's one of these signs, or a similar sign to this, as you come into Enola, I think, isn't there? The churches of Enola welcome you, or churches of the West Shore welcome you. It doesn't list all of them, though, I don't think. This is Azusa, California. Guess what? When Paul went to Rome in shackles to face Nero, because he appealed to Caesar, he didn't pass one of these signs on the way into Rome. And you didn't pass this kind of a sign on the way into any other city. It wasn't about choice. It wasn't about, I think, you know, you grow up and think, I wonder what religion I'll be. That's not how it was. And it wasn't forced on you either. So how was it? I think this is probably one of the more important things that I might talk about, because it's so different than what we experience today. And if we want to read Paul, if we want to read the New Testament, we got to get in their sandals and not and out of our shoes. In the Roman Empire, not just in the Roman Empire, in the ancient world, gods are in the blood. Does that make any sense? What do I mean by that? Anybody know what I mean by that? Want to take a guess?
Well, they were just so ingrained in their culture and in their being that it was hard to sort of detach from them, I would guess.
Right. You were born. When you're born, you have a father, your mother, you have a god, or a bunch of gods, because you came from this stock, and this stock has this history, and this stock has these gods. And that's just the way it was. Nobody questioned it. You had your God. Your city had your God. The city next door had his God, or gods. And that was okay. It was an ancient relationship. My father, my grandfather, his father before him, his father before him. It's just always been this way. We'll see something. If I have time, I want to turn to turn to one of the something that happened in Ephesus. There are many gods. Some are more powerful than others. How than others? What about when this city fights this city and one of them wins? What's that an indication of? My God is more powerful than your God. You know, when the Jewish revolt happened in 70 AD, that didn't tell the Romans that the Jewish God did not exist. It just told them that their God was more powerful than the Jewish God right now. And maybe, not because the Roman gods are more powerful than the Jewish gods, but maybe just because the Jews were displeasing their gods right now, so they didn't. He wasn't going to act on their behalf. Displeasing their gods, sorry. And he wasn't going to act on their behalf. Sometimes it's not a matter of power of the gods. It could be a matter of who's pleasing whom. And if you're not pleasing the gods won't act in your favor. Why were the Jews sometimes called atheists? They were called atheists. Why? Because they didn't believe in the gods. They believe in a god. They didn't believe in the gods. So they were called atheists. Atheists. They were against the gods. They didn't believe in the gods. Now, we talked about it before, and it was true in the whole empire, that under Augustus and his good relationship with the Herods and so forth, there were exceptions made for Judaism because it was an ancient religion. It was in their blood just as much as the other gods were in the blood of the others. So the Romans accepted that. I think I have a slide on that, so I'll stop. This is important to remember. Any god is more powerful than any human. Why does that matter? It matters because if you want to, you want things to go well, you need to have all the gods on your side. Not just your personal god, your family's god. You want them all because they all have power. They're all more powerful than any human. Even the weak gods, even the gods with their foibles, are more powerful than the most powerful human. So we need to appeal to all the gods. And that's what the Romans did. That's why the Romans didn't have a problem with Yahweh, with the Jewish God. It was just one more God. They had hundreds of gods. They didn't care they had one more. Let him be for us too. I think I mentioned this before. If I didn't, I'll tell you. The Jews in the temple sacrificed. They had two sacrifices a day for the emperor. They weren't sacrificing to the emperor. They were sacrificing on behalf of the emperor, asking God to bless, the emperor for whatever. And they had prayers for the emperor. Is that wrong? Well, Paul says pray for those in power. We may lead a good life and so forth. So I don't know that there's anything wrong with that. So that was their accommodation, with Rome in a sense. And that kind of greased the tracks around the whole empire. That, all right, we only have, if your God, if you're in Thessalonica, your God is over there in Palestine. And that might be a problem. I'll get to that maybe if I remember in a minute. But we still want that God to be on our side. So all gods need to be honored. That's the Roman way of looking at it, or the Greek way of looking at it. And to displease any of the gods is to invite curses. You're asking for it. So we don't want to displease any of them. We want all those gods on our side. Now that's so different than what we talk about now, right? We think about religion. We're going to embrace a religion. They didn't think about that at all. It was part of their way of life. Their city had gods. Their family had gods. That was part of their culture. You remember, it goes way back. It didn't just start in the Roman Empire. Remember when Jacob left Laban and Rachel had her little idols with her, her teraphim, they call them. They're household idols. She stole a few of them. That was normal. You wanted them all on your side. If I don't get to it, remind me. I want to talk a little bit about, I think I'll get to it. I think I have it in my notes. About the fact that all the other gods were local, and the Jewish God was kind of appeared that way too to the Romans. It was local over there to Judea. But wherever you lived in the empire, you honored that God. And that might have caused a little contention. I already mentioned this. In the diaspora, there's epigraphic evidence, that means things that are carved in stone, that some Jews allowed their names to be associated with the pagan gods of the cities. And some people, like Paula Fredrickson, one of the resources that I use, and I like her research, but she will see a few inscriptions, and then she'll make a generalization based on that, which I don't think is valid. I didn't mention my resources. I've read, over the years, lots of books that have to do with the touch on this, like Stendhal's book and Sanders' book. But specifically for this one, I listened to a course from the Teaching Company on the decline of paganism and the rise of Christianity in the Roman Empire by Kenneth Harrell. That was very good. I recommend that. I recommend Harrell. He's just interesting on Rome. What else did I look at? I looked at some of Fredrickson's lectures and essay or papers, and now something else is slipping my mind that I needed to remember. Oh, Barclay, John Barclay, Jews in the Mediterranean Diaspora, which is a huge book. I only read parts of it. But I don't think we should make too much of the fact that maybe a Jewish name appears on this inscription having to do with some pagan temple, because for several reasons. I don't think we should generalize based on a few. Maybe this person didn't care, but that doesn't mean his neighbor didn't care and everybody in the city didn't care. It also might be a connection that just appears that way because, all right, you helped work on it. Maybe you're a craftsman and you worked on this or whatever, and your name gets on there. And it doesn't mean you supported their god or you sacrificed to their god, but maybe you did some work or maybe you supplied something that got used there. I don't know that necessarily means. Now, maybe that you're part of that pagan culture. Now, maybe you're part of that pagan culture more than a Pharisee would allow himself to be. But in the diaspora, these kinds of things were more or less accepted. These people have been out there in other parts of the empire for centuries. Their families have been there for centuries, and they found ways to accommodate themselves and their religion to the local situation. All right? And so when Paul, who was a Pharisee and who was trained in Jerusalem, even though he didn't live there, wasn't born there, when he goes there, he understands from being, you know, a resident of Tarsus that it's different out there. Right? It's different. It's not like it is in Judea. And it affects what he says, and it affects how he writes. Pagans, on the other hand, were oftentimes benefactors of Jewish projects. They often contributed to the building of synagogues. Why? Why would they do that? Why do you think so? Anybody got an idea? Why would a pagan contribute to a Jewish synagogue? To make money?
Yeah.
You think all if they?
If he's helping build.
Oh well, why would they contribute money though? Why would they just donate money?
Oh,
hoping maybe to get something back. That could be too. Well, you know, in some cities we don't have good figures. There are different estimates, but 10% is an estimate that's pretty common. But in some cities it might have been more Jews than 10%. Some cities may have been less. Yeah, 10% of the population. Oftentimes, back in those days, in the ancient world, they weren't allowed into the guilds, so they couldn't be tradesmen a lot of times. So what did they get? They got into finance. Sometimes they had, you know, it kind of happens today. We have them involved in monetary transactions. So it was benefit to you to be on their good side, because there was a large portion of the population. They had influence in a significant part of the economy. So it just made sense. They were a large part of the community. And why wouldn't you want to be their friend? And they had been there for centuries. They didn't just show up yesterday. So religion, the way we talk about it, is a modern concept. It's not, in the ancient world, it wasn't like that. You were born into your system of belief. This included a respect for gods that were not your god. You know, you didn't have to sacrifice to these other gods necessarily, but if you were in their city, you would. It wouldn't bother you. You respected all kinds of gods. That's just the way it was. And the gods are responsible for and involved in everything. There was no division like we have today between the secular and the religious. You had a pretty day like today, the gods gave you a pretty day. You have a bad day, the gods gave you that bad day. You were unsuccessful in business, the gods weren't smiling on you because you did something wrong. You had a good day, you know, the gods were smiling on you. The gods were involved in everything. That's the way the ancient world was. Jews were like that too. You read the Bible, the Old Testament. I think there's some of that comes through. Where you know, there was a lack of understanding sometimes for the natural origin of certain things, and so everything got credited to the gods. Although Jews were monotheists, they made enough accommodations for the most part, to be accepted in the cities where they lived. They lived there for centuries. They made accommodations, and it was likely in large part due to their economic success. All right, this is a synagogue that's been dug up and partially reconstructed. It's in Sardis. It's one of the best examples of an ancient synagogue that we have today. And why do I have that one here? I forget. We're going to look at Paul's city, I think. Paul's city is where he went. But first, before we look at that, I want to talk about who went to the synagogues. Do you ever think about that? You probably have. Who went to the synagogues? What's the easy answer? Jews went to the synagogue. Who else went to the synagogue?
Converted Christians.
Before there were Christians. You're right. Christians also. Because they were Jews sometimes. Or whatever. But even before there were any Christianity, who else went to synagogues besides Jews?
They had slaves.
Well, slave could be, yeah. I mean, this isn't a trick question. Gentiles went to synagogue. And there were different kinds of Gentiles. One, and this is confusing, or can be confusing. We need to be careful. Sometimes people will say, well, converted Gentile, a proselyte. Guess what? That person's a Jew. Right? Once you convert the whole way, if you're male, you get circumcised, the whole deal, then you're a Jew. You're not a Gentile anymore. So you're one of the Jews. But there were other Gentiles. There were Gentiles who came to the synagogue. One of the titles, one of the terms that's used is called God-fearers. I'll get to that in a minute. And the jury's still out exactly about who's God-fearers and who, you know, exactly what they were. They were sympathetic to the Jewish way of life. They wanted to learn a little bit of, you know, from Moses. There are some scholars that say that what was significant about them is that they were interested in the Jewish God, but they weren't interested in giving up their own ancestral gods. Okay, so that they could come, learn about Yahweh, and, you know, on another day, another time, honor their own gods. You can't prove that one way or the other, I don't think. Others would say, well, when you came to the synagogue, you started to learn, and this makes sense, you started to learn about monotheism, and you started to realize that your gods weren't real gods. They were demons or they're whatever. But even Paul, and I won't turn there, Paul sometimes, or maybe we'll turn there, sometimes talks about Jews, or I'm sorry, talks about gods, that they're other gods. And to him, they're demons, you know, not gods in the same sense. So he doesn't deny, and the Bible doesn't deny the fact that there are other gods, small g, in the sense that they, you know, the Satan and his demons rule the world. So who came? Well, Gentiles came. Gentiles came to the synagogue. Why would you go to synagogue? There's no command to go to synagogue in the Torah. Why would you go?
To learn.
To learn. And why was that a good place to learn? What'd they have that you probably didn't have?
Scrolls.
They had scrolls. They could. That's where you went to hear the scrolls read, because you didn't have them. And maybe you couldn't read if you did have them. But you could go to the synagogue and hear them read. That's where the law was read. That's how you learn about your ancestral religion, or if you were a Gentile, you learn about the Jewish religion. Because they had the scrolls. Synagogues also seem to function as a bit of a community center. Because the Gentiles had all their framework, whatever, infrastructure for how you'd be involved and get your education and do all this kind of stuff. So in a big enough city, the Jews would have something in a similar scale, where their kids could be educated, where they could meet, get together, where they could have their social activities and so forth. That revolved around the synagogue as well, because they didn't have the temple. They didn't have the Temple Mount. They weren't in Judea. They had to create their own space to worship and to practice their religion. Acts chapter 15. Well, you know this one. Acts 15. I'll just read. You know, when Peter and James had finalized it, you know what the decree they were going to give the Gentiles that had become Christians. Oh, to get back to who attended the synagogues. Yes, as Dan said, once there were conversions to Christianity, Christians attended the synagogues. And sometimes Paul got himself kicked out, and the apostles got themselves kicked out, or the ones that went with Paul. But the locals got to attend there, and that's where they got to hear the law read and so forth. Especially if you're a Gentile, where else are you going to learn it? So in Acts 15, verse 21, he said, well, you know, they need to do these things, and all the abstain from pollution, from idols, and from fornication, and from things strangled, and from blood. All these things had to do with idol worship. They had to stop this, okay? If you come into the church, you need to stop these things. And he says, for Moses of old time had them in every city that preach him being read in the synagogues every Sabbath day. Just like Darlene said. That's where you go to hear Moses read, to hear the law. And by that time, probably they were reading the prophets as well. So you got to hear the law read to you and learn what was in the scrolls. In Acts 13 and verse 14, let's see, where are they here? This is where, remember Paul was there Perga. Is it Perga? In Pamphylia? And they came to Antioch in Pisidia, and when he sat down on the Sabbath day, and the people said, "Do you have anything you want to say?" And Paul took advantage of that opportunity to give him a sermon, right? He was a visitor, and they let him speak. And here's how he started his message. After the reading of the law and the prophets, okay, so they were reading the prophets then, the rulers of the synagogue sent unto them, saying, "You men and brethren, if you have any word of exhortations for the people, say on." Paul stood up, held his hand up, and said, "Men of Israel, and you that fear God, give audience. Listen to me." So he addresses two groups of people. Men of Israel, that's who? Jews. And you who fear God. That's another group of people that are there in the synagogue that are not Jews. So we get from Paul's talking here that there were other people, and we see it as we go through his travels, that there are other people in the synagogue besides Jews. The Gentiles are there to learn about God as well, to learn about the Jewish God. Sorry. All right, so I've run through a lot of information, a lot of material, and now I want to take some time, however much time we have left, to go through some scriptures and see if these scriptures might come alive a little bit based on the things that we've talked about, things that we've discussed. And might as well turn in to Acts 13, because that's where we are anyway. Paul's in Antioch of Pisidia. Let's see, what do I have there? Okay, there we've got a panoramia, it's called. This Antioch of Pisidia is a deserted area right now. But every Roman city of any size had an arena like this, or an amphitheater, where you could meet, have meetings and so forth. This was normal. And let's see. When Paul wrapped up his talk, I think, at some point, was it verse 26? "Men and brethren, children of the stock of Abraham, and whosoever among you fears God." So you got some people who are of the stock of Abraham, and you have some people who just fear God. They're not of the stock of Abraham. This is the typical synagogue audience. It's a mixture of Jews and Gentiles in the diaspora. Probably wasn't that way in Judea, but in the diaspora it was different. That's why I wanted to give this sermon, to show you that it's different. The areas that Paul went to are different than the areas in Judea around Jerusalem. I'll get to verse 42 here. So, that we're still in Antioch of Pisidia. Now, that's a different Antioch, right? I need to go. Sorry, I didn't repeat the map. Oh, it's going to take a while. Apologize. This isn't good. There's probably a way to do this. Oh, come on. There. Antioch of Pisidia is right there. That's not the Antioch I talked about in the sermon a while back. That's down here. Different Antioch. Meanwhile, I'll just keep doing this. Verse 42. "And when the Jews were gone out of the synagogue, the Gentiles besought that these words might be preached to them the next Sabbath." So, the Gentiles were already in the habit of going to the synagogue on the Sabbath. Some of these Gentiles that were interested. And some would say that they are the God-fearers. And they wanted to hear. "Now when the congregation was broken up, many of the Jews and religious proselytes followed Paul and Barnabas. When I speak to them, persuaded them to continue in the grace of God. The next Sabbath came, almost the whole city came together to hear the word of God." Verse 44. The Jews didn't like that. All right, they start getting jealous. The early persecution of Christians came from the Jews, not the Romans. Because the Romans didn't have a problem with it. Yet. They do later. Not in the time of most of when the Bible was written. There was a persecution under Nero. He tried to blame Christians for burning. Tried to blame his mother for something. That's when the Senate finally had it with him. He had murdered his mother, and then he tried to blame her for something. And one of the senators just walked out of his speech. And that was kind of the signal, like, all right, we can do him in now. But he killed himself before they had a chance to do it. He was crazy. But he had a rather limited persecution. His persecution was in Rome. That's when Paul was killed, and probably Peter and some others. The big Christian persecutions, or the big one, it was later, under Diocletian, around 300 and whatever it was, 303. So Nero had outlawed them, but nobody really ever enforced that law. Now, Paul and Barnabas answered. Now, this is important, and we see it other places in Acts. In verse 46, Paul and Barnabas waxed bold. And they answered, I'm not going to read it here, but they answered the Jews and said, you know, it is by design. God wants us to speak to you first, but since you're not going to listen, we're going to take it to the Gentiles. But Paul never lost his desire to take the gospel to the Gentiles. You read through the book of Romans. The whole book of Romans, just instead of trying to study the book of Romans sometime, because it'll bog you down for years, just read through it like it's a novel. And what comes through there is Paul's love for and his concern for his countrymen, that he wants them to be saved. And it may be they'll be jealous that the Gentiles are being saved, or whatever else, however else he phrases it. But he wants his brothers, his Jewish brothers and sisters, to be saved, to accept Christ. He always had that with him. He went to the Jews first. He went to the synagogue first in the cities where he went. Let's see if there's anything else I want to read here in this chapter. Well, the Jews, they ended up, they'd chase Paul to another city, and then he'd go to another city and have a little success there, and then they'd move if the city was close enough, like Lystra and Derbe were, and they'd go down there and bother him there, too. Sometimes they would follow him around just to be a pain. Paul, because he was not liked for preaching to the Gentiles. And here's where I'll go into this little excursus here. Why do you think maybe some of the Jews didn't like what Paul was preaching to the Gentiles? Because they didn't have to keep the entire Torah. They didn't have to keep the whole law. They had to believe in Christ and Jesus as Messiah. And they had to do some other things, and they should do some things, and they met with the Jews and so forth. Why do you think maybe there was some jealousy? Now, can't prove this, just want you to think a little bit. The Jews had spent years, generations, centuries in some cases, developing this relationship with the Romans. And they had certain privileges. They had certain exceptions to laws. Now, this Paul comes along preaching that these Gentiles can join the church, okay, and not become Jews first, or at all. To the Romans, these Gentiles, were what? They were Jews. They joined this Christian. There wasn't a Christianity then. There was just this sect, like we had the Pharisees, we had the Sadducees, we had the Essenes, we had the Zealots. I mean, we got the Christians. It's some Jews. They worship on a Sabbath. They eat kosher. They do these things. And now we have Gentiles joining them. Well, they're not Gentiles anymore. They're Jews. And they get the benefits to the Jews. Now, I'm just thinking here. I can't prove this. But is it possible that the Jews may have been a little bit jealous that these Gentiles, these Johnny-come-latelys, get to come in and get all the benefits, and they haven't done a thing? And not only that, they don't have to do a thing. It's bad enough that they didn't do anything to deserve it up till now. But that's fine, because we always understood the prophets say that Messiah, they didn't believe that Jesus was Messiah, but the Messiah would be an ensign to the Gentiles. They always understood that the Gentiles would be brought into the people of Israel. But their understanding was, and always and still was, that they would have to join Israel. They would have to be converted. The men would have to be circumcised. They'd have to be under the entire law. And Paul's saying, nah, it's not that way. How did they come to that conclusion? Well, he went out in the desert for 3 years, apparently, and thought about it. Maybe that's how he did. But also because what happened at the beginning? These people were baptized. These Gentiles were baptized, and they began expressing the gifts of the Spirit, like speaking in tongues, and they hadn't been converted to become Jews. God showed, and this is what they talked about in Acts 15, God showed that they were one and the same. That he had accepted these Gentiles just as he accepted the Jews. He proved it by the same signs. And they didn't have to go through all this conversion. So if you were a Jew, you might be excused, humanly speaking, for a little bit of jealousy. Maybe. Maybe that's part of it. There's also a certain amount of just natural desire for control. You know, you have all these Gentiles that come into the the synagogue, and you have control over them and what they're going to learn, what they're going to do. And now you get this Paul coming preaching something else, and you lose control. Nobody likes that. Okay, in chapter 1 of verse 14, then they went to Iconium, and they went together into the synagogue of the Jews and spoke to so that a great multitude of the Jews and the Greeks believed. So they went into a synagogue, and there are a lot of people in Iconium. There's Iconium. Whoa! It's a big city in Turkey, seventh biggest city in Turkey today. So it's hard to find the old Iconium. It's Kionia, something like that. But when you went to a synagogue, Paul expected to preach to a mixed group of people that it had Jews and Gentiles. Why would that be? Because Judaism, for whatever its reasons, was popular to a certain extent in the diaspora. By the way, diaspora, it's a Greek word. I don't know what it means, scattering or something. It's a term, I didn't explain it. It's a term that refers to the Jews that weren't in Judea, around the rest of the world. You could use it in terms of anybody, but it's most commonly used for referring to Jews. By the way, in verse 11 of chapter 14, something I think is somewhat, or let's look at like verse 10. Paul had healed somebody, and then they wanted to worship him. But he was in Lystra now, I think, or Derbe. He was in a little more of a rural area. And they couldn't understand these people. They spoke a different language. They spoke their local language. Why? It's a smaller city, smaller town, village, whatever it was. They didn't have quite the Hellenic infrastructure that the big cities had. So this is a little different. And the people were a little bit cruder. And they were ready to worship him as Jupiter and Barnabas as some whatever. It says there, Mercury and so forth. And he had to say, no, you know, can't do that. In Acts 15, we already read about the four rules. Now, if the scholars who say that God-fearers did not have to give up their ancestral gods are right, and I don't know if they are or they're not right, and the evidence is not, the Bible doesn't spell it out, and other things that we discover doesn't spell it all out. But if they're right, and God-fearers could kind of be on the fence and still come to the synagogue and learn about the God of Israel and not give up their local gods and their ancestral gods, if that's true, then do you realize what happened when Paul came along and Barnabas and the others? Because he's preaching Christianity now. And he's saying, if you want to be a Christian, there's one God. Of course, the Jews said that too. And if you converted to Judaism, you would give up your other gods. But now they didn't have to convert to Judaism, but they still were expected to give up their other gods. Right? Only one God. And you can't honor and worship the others. This is a problem. And I'm not going to take the time to read it, but you remember when they were in Ephesus? What happened? This silversmith got the people all riled up. Why did he do that? Because he made the little trinkets that the visitors got when they went to the temple of Diana or Artemis, right? Ephesus was a huge tourist center. So was Jerusalem, for that matter. Because Jerusalem had a wonderful temple, beautiful temple. Well, so did Ephesus. Well, and when people came, you bought something to take home with you. That's just the way it was. Nothing's changed there, has it? And this coppersmith said, oh, you know, these people are going to take away our livelihood because they're teaching that these other gods don't exist. I do want to turn there. Let's see what. Here we go. This is Lystra. There is no Lystra anymore. I don't know why I have a picture of Caligula here. He's the one that was assassinated because he was crazy. I'm not sure why he ends up here. Or no, he's not. Maybe that's. I wrote Claudius, but it's Caligula. All right. This is this picture of some of the public services that are available in Ephesus. I'm all for cities if this is where you have to go to find them. There's 50. That's a 50-holer. They're just seeing a little part of it. But in Ephesus, where are we? I think it's in chapter 19. I just want to read one thing here. Basically, you know, there was a riot. And then the city fathers, you know, they have these people that are responsible for the cities. There's a name for it. I forget the name. It starts with a D. And the town's clerk came and appeased the people, said, "You men of Ephesus, what man is there that doesn't know how that the city of Ephesus is a worshiper of the great goddess Diana and of the image which fell down from Jupiter? Seeing then that these things cannot be spoken against, you ought to be quiet and do nothing rashly." And he says, you know, you can go to court. You got a problem with these guys, you can go to court. We'll hear the case. But notice what he says. This is according to Luke writing it. He says, you know, these guys come and say, it doesn't really matter what they say. We all know better. You know, we've been here forever. This guy just showed up and he's going to preach. Let him preach what he preaches. We know better. Who cares? Don't get all worked up about it. The way Luke phrases it, he said, we all know that this city worships Diana. That was their local god. And she was also a big shot god, Artemis. So you don't have to get all excited because we know better. Who cares what these guys say? So that goes back to what I was saying, just the way that the religion of the Roman Empire was part of their blood. It was part of their character. It was part of their whole, it was part of the city, it was part of everything. And yes, you can get all excited about somebody like Paul, but a rational, you know, somebody with a little more sense and a little more, you know, concern that maybe the Romans would come in and the army might come in and cause a problem. You say, all right, settle down. We all know better. Come on. You know, we've been here for generations. Our parents have been here. We've been here forever. We know. Yeah, let these guys go. So to me, that just proves the point of how ingrained in the culture their gods were and how they took it for granted. And Paul was really up against it when he's saying they don't exist. But we see that Gentiles accepted that. And to do that, to accept Christianity, they had to give up their gods. Well, I don't want to go a whole lot longer, so I won't. Just to say, I was going to turn to, and you can read it, 1 Corinthians 8, 1 Corinthians 10, and Romans 14. And I might read a verse or two from there. But you know, when you were in Ephesus, or Smyrna, or Thyatira, or Rome, or Athens, or anywhere else, this isn't where you got your meat. You didn't get to go to the store like this. You might have to go to the Parthenon if you're in Rome. You know, the meat market was tied in with the sacrificial worship of the gods. And Paul, you can read it. I won't bother reading it. In three chapters, specifically talks about it. Some people want to misquote this and say, oh, Paul's talking about clean and unclean meats, or he's talking about days that, you know, the Sabbath and things like that. He's not talking about that at all. He's talking about people that are sensitive to the fact that their meat may have been sacrificed to an idol, and they're uncomfortable with that. In the diaspora, in most of these cities where there were large Greek or large Jewish populations, accommodations had been made. The Jews had their own butchering. Because there was not just whether it was sacrificed to an idol or not, it was how it was butchered. You know, the apostle said, stay away from things that are strangled. You know, that has to be bled properly. And so on. In any city with a substantial Jewish population, this was taken care of. There were places where things were butchered so that the Jews could eat them. But if you went to a neighbor's house or you went to some festival or whatever, you didn't know for sure where that meat had been killed and how. And Paul says in 1 Corinthians, he also says in Romans, you know, you don't have to know, it's okay. Those gods are nothing. But if you offend somebody else who's sensitive about that, you're guilty. So don't offend others. Now, who are you going to offend? Weak Gentiles? Now I'm going to throw out something from Mark Nanos. That's another person I read from the Mystery of Romans. He says his opinion is, and it has some merit, I think. I don't know if I agree or not, but I think about it anyway, that the weak in Romans 14, or the weak all throughout Romans, are Jews who have not converted to Christianity yet, who may when Paul comes and preaches. Paul hasn't been to Rome yet. Paul doesn't want Gentiles. This is the way Mark sees it. Nano sees it. Paul does not want Gentiles who can eat the food that's been sacrificed to idols, and they know the idols are nothing, and it doesn't mean anything to them. He doesn't want them to offend their fellow worshipers in the synagogue by doing that. When Paul hasn't even had a chance to get there and preach Christ to them yet. I think there's some merit to that. It's just worth thinking about. Paul says he wants to come to Rome. He's going to come to Rome. He did end up going and changed. But I don't know. I don't know that that's, I can't prove it, but I think it's worth thinking about. That Paul is even concerned about his countrymen. And again, if you read through the book of Romans, it's all like that. He's concerned about them. And he wants them to be saved like he's been saved. And he doesn't want a bunch of recently converted Gentiles who have the freedom to eat this meat to offend the ones they worship with. So that they're just so offended they're not going to listen to Paul when he shows up. I think there's something to be said for that. I can't prove it again. You know, in the very first slide, I had Jews in the Mediterranean diaspora, and I didn't explain why I had the little sub. Did you notice the subhead? Did anybody pay attention? What did I have there? Been there, done that. I put that there. It's just my own little thing. Because these Jews had been in the diaspora for hundreds of years. They had dealt with living in a Gentile culture and what to do about it and how to do about it. They were not so hung up on whether the inside or the outside of the cup was pure. That wasn't their issue. They had other issues. They had to wonder whether or not the meat that they were going to eat was sacrificed to idols. Okay, didn't have to worry about that in Judea, did you? It's a different world. Paul does not spend time in his letters talking about purity laws in terms of inside and outsides of cups and, you know, washings and all this kind of stuff. You see that in the Gospels, but you don't see it in Paul's letters. These people dealt with that years ago. And they had worked it out. Now they had some different issues. The issues were that with Christianity, you didn't have to convert to be a Jew, but you couldn't just be a Gentile God-fearer that was coming around just to see about this Yahweh and then went home and did your regular ancestral stuff. You had to give up that ancestral stuff. These gods, these other gods, did not exist except as demons and as lesser gods, if you want to put it that way. But there's only one true God who created the universe. That was a big change, big difference. And the Jews in the diaspora were not really prepared to handle the influx of Gentiles. And there's a whole lot of history that comes after this. It's very interesting. I enjoy studying it. And the end result is a Gentile church that's anti-Jewish. And it went on crusades and fought against Jews at the same time they were fighting against Muslims. You know, I'm talking hundreds of years in the future. So one other thing I want to point out, and I didn't put it in my notes, but I need to point this out. And that is, in Acts 15, they say, oh, just these four things. Just worry about these four things. You hear the law, you hear Moses preached every week. There's one thing, there's a lot of things, I guess, but there's one important thing that those men did not know. And it's one important thing that Paul did not know when you read what he says. And he's talking about, here's how we're going to deal with this. Here's how we're going to deal with this. There's one great big elephant in the room. A piece of very important information that God had not chosen to reveal to him and hadn't revealed to the original apostles. Might it have changed the way they would have done things? Maybe if they'd have known. I don't know. You know, why? Yeah, all right, we'll just give them these four things and we'll just move on. It seems almost kind of quick and rash. If it does, I'm not saying it is or it isn't, I'm just saying it comes across that way a little bit to me. Why might that be? Why might they not have said, well, we got to think about this for a year and we'll come back. We'll have another meeting. What was their mentality about the times that they lived in? The end was very, very near. Paul said, those of us who are alive and remain, they expected Jesus to come back soon, real soon. They understood that when the Gentiles came and joined to the people of Israel, that this was the eschatological, all right? That's a big word, means end of time. This was the fulfillment of the things that the prophets had talked about that wasn't going to happen until the end time. Now we say, oh, it's been 2,000 years. It wasn't the end time. Well, it wasn't. The prophets did predict that these things would happen in the end of days, and this is what happened. And in a way, or in some way, I haven't got it all worked out. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. But in some way, the kingdom came in a way. But not the fullness of it. We're still waiting. But certain things happened. The Spirit came. The Spirit gave gifts. Young men dream dreams. Old men have visions. You know, whatever. You know, Paul quoting Joel. Things happened that were different than what had been in the old covenant, the old time, the Old Testament. Things were different. So they knew they were in a different time because all these Gentiles were coming into the people of God. They just had no idea how long it would be.